ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Can the future really be made in Australia? And more specifically, can it be made in Queensland? Hello, I'm Callie Buchanan. The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has made the case for the Future Made in Australia Act, which he says will consist of a whole package of new and existing initiatives to boost investment and create jobs in critical industries. He says Australia needs to act and invest at scale and to be more assertive in capitalising on comparative advantages and building sovereign capability in areas of national interest. To do it, he says the government will continue to strengthen and invest in the foundations of economic success. The Prime Minister was deliberate when he chose Queensland to make the big pitch for his new vision on manufacturing.
I wanted to give this speech here in Queensland because you have such a pivotal role to play in realising that vision and building that future. I'm here in Brisbane, but our government's plan is about Gladstone and Mackay and Rockhampton and Townsville and Mount Isa and Cairns as well. Because for Australia to seize the opportunities of the next decade, for our nation to generate the energy, skills, jobs, technology and investment that will power our future prosperity, we need every community in Queensland included, involved and empowered. Cities, suburbs and regions alike. We need Queenslanders everywhere to be able to access high quality education and training for good, secure jobs. We need Queenslanders everywhere breaking ground on new infrastructure, building new energy projects and mastering new technologies. And we need Queenslanders everywhere to be part of a new advanced manufacturing workforce, researching, designing, building and exporting value-added products to the world. Queensland has always been a great resources state, a great energy state, and of course a smart state. Its coal, gas and other resources have helped to power our national economy, and so have the ideas and dynamism of its people. Queensland's role as a resource and energy and innovation state will continue, and it will evolve, because Queensland resources and energy and technology will contribute to making Australia a renewable energy superpower. Queensland will be at the forefront in helping the nations in our region grow, industrialise and decarbonise, and help the world achieve its net zero goals.
Anthony Albanese says the economy will suffer without significant government intervention to attract investment. But he acknowledges that when it comes to spending, Australia can't match the likes of the United States Inflation Reduction Act. This is essentially a law that's made a giant pot of money, more than half a billion Australian dollars worth, for programs and funding to accelerate the transition to net zero in the US. The Prime Minister again.
This won't be a one-off. It's about building an enduring framework that can adapt over time. Obviously, Australia cannot go dollar for dollar with the United States Inflation Reduction Act. But this is not an auction. It's a competition, and Australia can absolutely compete for international investment when it comes to our capacity to produce outcomes, the quality of our policies and the power of our incentives. As the Treasurer said, part of the objective here is about Australia presenting potential investors with a single front door, a clear path to investing in Australia, in Queensland, in hydrogen, in green metals, and in advanced manufacturing. And the right skills, supply chains and processes to get projects up and going and see this investment realise a positive return. Above all, this is about giving Australian businesses, Australian communities and the Australian people every possible opportunity to benefit from this moment.
So how realistic is it to bring manufacturing back onshore? Tristan Edis is the Director of Analysis and Advisory at Green Energy Markets. He says while it may be politically popular to move away from a reliance on China for manufacturing, it won't be easy to be globally competitive in this space.
The problem is I'm sceptical about whether the government really understands just what's involved if they want to invest at globally competitive scale here, particularly in clean energy. So the $1 billion that they announced for solar, it barely touches the site. It's like a down payment, a small down payment on creating a solar industry. It is just not enough. You've got to be talking tens of billions of dollars if you want to create a meaningfully globally competitive industry. To help put this in perspective, I would sit there and say solar panel manufacturing, we're just really not going to, we just don't have a hope, to be completely honest. And to put it in perspective, so Australia's entire conventional power generation infrastructure of coal, gas and hydro is 50 gigawatts. In China, every 9 months, they can add a new factory that produces 20 to 30 gigawatts per annum of solar panels. So just one single factory built within 9 months can produce more generating capacity from solar PV than our entire existing conventional plant. That's the scale. So if you sit there and say, we don't want to be too reliant on China and we want to manufacture it here domestically. If you're going to do it and it's going to be competitive, cost competitive, you can't be focused just on Australia. You have to be focused on the globe to be globally competitive, even in the US. In the US right now, they're paying twice the price for their solar panels than we are because they are trying to put up a range of trade barriers against the Chinese. So that as a consequence, they're paying twice the price we are for solar panels. Are we prepared to do that? That would actually inhibit our ability to become a clean energy superpower if we essentially going to do the same thing the US does. They do that on top of the fact that they're throwing hundreds of billions of dollars at creating new manufacturing facilities in the US. Now that if it is succeeding, they're going to add 105 gigawatts of new solar manufacturing facilities in the US as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act. But to put that again, how are we going to compete against the US, let alone China with this? So that's the challenge there. So we have to pick our battles really cleverly in this space. It's the same with battery manufacturing. You know, the scale of what's going on in the US and China, and scale is fundamental to cost competitiveness. It's the same in a range of other industries where you really have to be realistic. The US struggles to compete in computer chip manufacturing, for example. They used to dominate that. Now they struggle to compete in it because the scale is so pivotal. You have to build a factory for the world to be competitive.
How much of this speech by Anthony Albanese was setting out a vision for a second term in power, given that we have a federal election coming up in about a year's time?
I think one of the things that I understand where the Prime Minister is coming from is he's going to regions like Gladstone and like the Hunter Valley. And in those places, coal mining has been a source of high-wage jobs for people that haven't got a university education, and they want to have a good life for their family. They want to create a good life for their family. And he's trying to present an alternative future option for those people to say, hey, look, I know coal mining is probably not going to last forever, but there are other alternatives that are going to pay you a secure, high-wage job that's going to mean a good life for your family. And we do need to find ways to deliver those options for these people in these regions. And that's both good politics, but it's also good economics. But the challenge is you've got to be quite selective about and realistic about what are those opportunities where you can do that. And I understand you need to be able to do that. You need to present an alternative, a positive alternative, but it's tough. Mm. And it requires a lot of really good thinking to be able to make it happen, given Australia's constrained resources and the scale of what we're competing against with China, the US, but also Europe.
Director of Analysis and Advisory at Green Energy Markets, Tristan Edis, speaking to Sarah Dingle. Whatever the detail of the Future Made in Australia Act looks like, the First Nations Clean Energy Network says it's an unmissable opportunity to include Indigenous Australians as partners in the development and planning. Executive Director Karina Nolan says local people need to be involved from the get-go.
We know that the clean energy transition is underway, but needs to happen absolutely at scale and at pace, and with, you know, our people at the centre of it, because we need to transition in order to kind of deal with the impacts of climate change, which many of our communities are already feeling. So we welcome the idea of there being a coordinated package of initiatives to bring together the work that's already well underway around policy and investment in renewables.
And what role would you like to see First Nations play in the development and implementation of this Act?
Yeah, we think this is a real opportunity to actually do the renewable energy industry differently. We want to make sure that our communities genuinely are able to consent and engage and actually enjoy the benefits from this industry. It's going to need 10,000 kilometres of transmission line. That's a lot of access to land, and it's going to need vast sort of areas of lands and waters that our traditional owners, you know, must be part of those decisions. And I think what we've been hearing from communities right around the country as we've been working with people is that when the projects are designed well and our communities are engaged really early on, you know, some of these projects have a lifespan of 70-odd years. It means that actually the projects are more successful, the investors, it's a more stable environment for investors. So actually having us genuinely involved from the beginning is something that, you know, our communities have been asking for.
Have there been any renewable energy projects so far in this country which really didn't involve First Nations people with adverse consequences?
We think there's a lot of work for the industry to do, and we've been really welcoming the work, the collaboration between community, industry and government to set best practice principles so that we can actually see this done differently and not, you know, repeat the mistakes of some of the mining that's been done on our country and to us in the past. So there's some good examples, there's some bad examples. And I think when we look to Canada, who are a decade ahead of us, one of the things that they said to us early on, the First Nations communities we've been working with, is that collaboration between industry and community and government is really key to making sure that this is really genuinely a successful renewable energy rollout.
And what did you think of the scale of this? Anthony Albanese hasn't attached any firm numbers to what this might involve so far, but what would you like to see?
Well, I think it's hard to put actual figures on it. Well, I mean, we can look to the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, which, you know, is a considerable amount of money.
And enormous. It's like more than half a billion Aussie, isn't it?
Yes. And they put aside a specific amount, so $720 million specifically for tribal nations. And part of that is to, you know, respect the custodial stewardship role that people have been taking to, you know, protect land and water and country, but also money for drought relief, electrification, you know, energy efficiency. And the Canadians have done something similar with the diesel reduction program. So we want to make sure that all of our communities have access to cheap, reliable, affordable power. And we do know that in Australia at the moment, there's something like 3 million rooftops that have solar, but we can't tell you how many of those are First Nations rooftops and homes. And we do know that many of our communities are currently being disconnected from power, which is just, you know, totally unacceptable. So we think there needs to be significant investment to make sure that every First Nations household in this country has access to affordable power. And we'd also really like to see, you know, a number of our, where the large scale projects will be, there's a local, you know, First Nations workforce that could be mobilised, because this is a, you know, this is a huge scale, this transition. And so we want to make sure that our communities are involved in every single part of it.
Karina Nolan, the Executive Director of the First Nations Clean Energy Network, speaking with Sarah Dingle. Of course, there's already been plenty of innovation in the green energy space happening in rural Australia. Take, for example, the owners of a former coal-fired power station in New South Wales, who are looking to weeds to help fuel its second lease on life as the nation's largest modern biomass generator. Amelia Bernasconi has the story.
On the red soil plains around Cobar, it's estimated there are millions of tonnes of invasive native scrub, or INS, a problem farmers have been battling for years. INS is a label given to native vegetation when it starts to take over a landscape. It depletes biodiversity, it competes for water and sunlight that would otherwise grow quality grazing grasses. At Etiwanda Station, the Mosley family has been regenerating their 20,000 hectare property to improve soil health and overall productivity, getting rid of some INS as part of the process. Andrew Mosley says it's enabled them to drastically increase stocking rates of their goats, sheep and cattle.
The issue is it's reached densities that far exceed what was normal 50, 80, 100 years ago. And in some places it's that dense, you know, it's hard to walk through, and so it doesn't grow grass from a, which is, you know, no good from a livestock enterprise, and it's also unhealthy from a biodiversity point of view too, because the ground's bare, hard, not capturing water, not growing any grass for biodiversity. We're extremely proud of what we've done with the landscape. It's healthier, it's more resilient, it's more productive. We're replacing problem native species with a beneficial native species. So I guess there's a big concern from the wider community that don't understand the issue is, are we just taking everything out and destroying, you know, the landscape? But we're not. It's what we can and can't do is controlled by the probably veg plans, and the veg plans are put together by local land services, which is a agency of the state government. So they really control what we can and can't do on the land and how much we have to leave, what species we can take. So it's pretty tightly controlled.
Getting rid of the INS, though, is costly and time-consuming.
Using big machines, dozers, you know, pushing the woody weeds into piles, burning them, and then, you know, some short-term cropping or other activities to keep it under control.
But now there could be a way to cash in on the INS.
Anywhere where you're burning anything, really, in my view, it should be putting into a power station creating electricity.
Richard Poole is the CEO of Verdant Earth Technologies, which bought the Redbank power station near Singleton in the Hunter Valley in 2018. He wants to restart the former coal-fired generator using the INS from Cobar, as well as waste cleared during roadworks, and eventually using their homegrown biofuels.
So if you want a like-for-like generation replacement for coal, it's a biomass generator. It delivers on 24/7. It actually supports wind and solar and batteries, and it really gives Australia the energy security it can need, utilising our massive natural resources.
In the past decade, 10 coal generators have closed down, and the Australian Energy Market Operator says the rest of Australia's coal fleet will retire within the next 15 years. With that, AEMO is forecasting an energy shortfall from as early as next year, despite it reporting considerable progress towards New South Wales' renewable energy targets. Electrochemical engineer Dr. Jessica Allen says the race is on to meet demand.
We're on a decarbonisation journey and we're hurtling full steam ahead. So basically what we need to do is anything and everything. We need as much solar, wind and renewable energy as possible, as well as the renewable energy generation. We also need storage, things like batteries, potentially pumped hydro, so that we can access and use energy when we need to.
Verdant Earth says Redbank would offer 151 megawatts to the grid, powering about 200,000 homes. Dr. Allen says what they're proposing at Redbank is a unique opportunity, but she's not sure if bioenergy will play a huge role going forward.
It kind of makes sense to make these high-value chemicals with biomass, rather than just burning them for electricity. That said, burning them for electricity in a plant that already exists with a feedstock that's a waste product also has its advantages. For Redbank, that plant already exists. A large amount of the upfront emissions, as well as cost, is already there. So it kind of makes sense from that point of view to use it what it's meant to do. I would be surprised to see biomass used for electricity generation large scale in Australia, mostly because it is difficult for that harvesting, processing and central facility. And all of the costs of that add up.
To build a site like Redbank from scratch is estimated to cost $720 million, more than double the price of a solar or wind farm of the same megawatt output. But to switch the site over from coal to biomass, Verdant Earth says will cost around $80 million. But the Redbank restart is facing some opposition. Jackie Mumford is the CEO of Nature Conservation Council New South Wales.
The transition to renewable energy is not going at the scale or speed required, we know that. It's going to take investment from government and certainty for investors so that we can get viable alternatives online in time to bring coal-fired power and other fossil fuels offline in the time that's required. If we have the necessary reform in the planning system, if we have the right incentives in place, we can absolutely get off fossil fuels in the time required without projects like this slowing us down. There is a lot of concern among the community about this project, you know, largely to do with tree clearing and the impacts that will have on the local environment, but also to do with climate change, with creating emissions that are going to drive climate change. And then there's the issue of air pollution. You know, burning timber products is a huge issue for air pollution. It creates PM2.5 particles in the atmosphere, which we know is associated with a raft of respiratory problems.
The Redbank plans are currently awaiting New South Wales government assessment. The state government declined an interview for this story. But regardless of the outcome on Redbank's future, the Mosley family plans to continue improving the health of Etiwanda Station. Andrew's daughter Emily can't stay away.
Absolutely love it. It's in the blood. I've been away for high school and university, but just kept getting drawn back out here and, yeah, got a real passion for it.
Emily Mosley, next generation grazier from New South Wales, ending that story from Landline's Amelia Bernasconi. And you can see it and more stories like it at any time on ABC iView. If you'd like to explore even further what it takes to put food on plates around the world, join me, Callie Buchanan, and our team of specialist reporters from across Queensland as we break down the big issues of rural life, from the food you eat to the clothes you wear and the home you live in. It's all available for you on the ABC Listen app. Just favourite the Queensland Country Hour or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.